Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we welcome 7th District U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, a Republican from Weston. He is back on the program for a chance to share his thoughts with you on the top international and domestic issues facing the people of North Central Wisconsin. Today on Route 51, we're going to ask Congressman Duffy about his priorities as he goes into his fourth year in office representing the 7th District and for his positions on the big issues of the day in foreign policy, on the increasing tensions and possible military action with Syria, and in domestic policy, immigration reform, the effort to defund the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, NSA spying and civil liberties, U.S. forestry policy, the push for gun control, the debate over climate change, the debt limit, the Voting Rights Act, and the president's so-called grand bargain, trading a cut in the corporate tax rate for a jobs program based on new infrastructure spending. Now, if you live in North Central Wisconsin, this is your opportunity to talk to Congressman Duffy one-on-one. He's taking your questions and comments live on the air for the next 45 minutes at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. And Sean, thanks so much for being with us today. It's good to be able to catch up with you for an update on something that is at least officially not a political year.
Well, it's great to be on, Glenn. Thanks for having me in, and it's great to have a good conversation about a lot of the issues that are taking place right now across the country.
Well, this is a news show. Any chance that we can make news today? Is there anything going on in Washington that affects the 7th Congressional District that we may not have heard about yet?
I think a lot of the issues that are taking place in Washington, D.C. are the issues that we hear on the front of our news stories, newspapers, and on our leading radio networks and on our TV stations. I mean, people are concerned about Syria. They're concerned about Obamacare and its funding and implementation and its impact on our healthcare sector. They're concerned about the debt limit. But most of all, they're concerned about jobs and the economy and economic growth and prosperity at a time when we've seen a lot of economic pain.
Well, Congress is about to go into session again. What are your top priorities for the rest of the year? What do you want to see happen?
Well, I guess I have to meld my priorities in with what I see happening over the course of the next 5 months. Specifically, I'm working on some reform legislation with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's a great name, but a lot of folks don't understand what they're actually doing in regard to gathering, collecting, and monitoring credit card transactions in real time of American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
We have the NSA, and that debate, we'll probably get to that a little bit later. But when you have this agency that, under the auspices of trying to protect you from your creditors, are gathering and collecting and storing and monitoring your credit card transactions, I find that to be outrageous. I want to make sure the agency like in politics, they can sample data to glean information about how rules, how regulations, how people are treated. But when you have real-time access to credit card transactions on 80% of credit cards that are out there, and there's 1.2 billion credit cards in America, this is a frightening power grab by this agency. So I'm working to push
back. Is this something new? Has this been happening for a while, or did you just find out about it?
This has been going on for several months. I have legislation dropping that would say, listen, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, if they want to monitor your credit cards, if they want to collect it and store it for 10 to 12 years, they should ask you, Glenn. They should say, hey, do you mind if we take this information? It's all for your benefit. Our government's looking out for you. Let us take all of your real-time credit card transactions. They should ask you that. And that's what I'm dropping legislation to that effect because most Americans don't know that besides what's going on with their phone records, with their Facebook, with their email, that their credit card transactions with another agency are being collected, stored, analyzed. And I have a hard time figuring out how that actually protects people from banks.
But there is legislation pending on that. Let's talk about the National Security Agency, since you brought it up. It's been defended as an important safeguard against terrorism, but the idea that phone records are being gathered indiscriminately is frightening to a lot of people. And for the first time, a public opinion poll indicates that more Americans are interested in protecting civil liberties in this regard than in protecting the country from a terrorist attack. Where do you come down on the entire NSA controversy?
Well, first, I want to make sure that we give our intelligence gathering apparatus sufficient leeway to keep America safe. But we also balance that with our civil liberties and our civil rights. And I think with information that's come out over the past several months, this agency has crossed the line and has infringed upon American civil liberties and civil rights. And I think I share the opinion of the poll you just referenced. I'm outraged by it. I want to be kept safe from foreign terrorists. You don't need to monitor Americans' emails and phone records and Facebook pages and credit card transactions. There's a new paradigm shift with the kind of information our government has on the American citizenry. I'm concerned about it, and I think a lot of people in central and northern Wisconsin are concerned as well. So we have to get back to that sweet spot, that balance point of where they have enough authority, but we still feel safe from our government. And I don't think America feels that way. I don't feel that way right now.
Let's talk about the situation in Syria. We appear to be on the brink of military action because of the apparent use, which seems to be confirmed at this point, of chemical weapons by the regime. Do you believe that military action at this point is wise? And if so, what kind of action do you favor? And do you believe, like a bipartisan group of congressmen do, who sent a letter to the White House, that Congress needs to be involved in the decision if we take military action?
And I'm on that letter. I think that Congress should be consulted, number one, and this should be an American government action as opposed to action exclusively by a president. We have the authority in Congress, and I think the president has to make sure he comes to us and consults with us. This is complicated. It's a complicated region. But you have Assad, a bad actor, and you have the rebels. Many of them are radical jihadists. Not all of them, but many of them are. And how you pick a winner, how you pick a loser in that battle, I think I don't think it can be done.
And apparently it's very factionalized. In other words, it's not just two groups. There are multiple groups opposing Assad.
Right.
Multiple interests.
That's right.
And who ends up on top?
And I don't know. And so when for every action, there's a reaction, and especially in the Middle East. And listen, if we take action, and the president's through many leaks, which concerns me as well, that we're telegraphing what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, unless the president's doing a head fake on us, and that could be the case too, and it could be a brilliant head fake. But you look at the information that has come out, and if that bears out to be true, the president's told Assad he doesn't want to have regime change. He's basically admitted that you can't take out the cache of chemical weapons. In essence, we're going to have a 2 to 3 day strike. That gives me pause. I go, well, what are we doing? Is this just a shot across the bow that doesn't really do anything, that could set off a chain of events that could be really negative, that actually now we really do have to engage? Is this for political cover? I'm one who believes we should stay out. Now, I haven't been invited to those secure briefings that are taking place today with leadership. I think we should be involved in that conversation. I've been excluded. But if the president wants us to get on board as members of Congress, he has to have a conversation with us. He has to sell us. And there has to be a well-thought-out plan, especially in the Middle East, because as we saw even in the Bush years, for every action there's a chain reaction, and sometimes you don't know where it brings you.
So you think the entire Congress needs to be involved in this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's move to the phones. We've got Congressman Sean Duffy, Republican, representing the 7th Congressional District with us today. And let's go to Peter in Phillips. Peter, you're on Route 51 with Sean Duffy.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Hello, Mr. Duffy.
Hi, Peter.
My concern is the money in politics. And I was wondering, what are you doing about campaign finance reform? It seems to me that any candidate who accepts contributions is corrupt.
Well, I think if you look at the structure of politics today, you have money that flows in from all sides of the aisle. In this race in rural Wisconsin, the largest, most sprawling and rural district in the state, the election that I had with Pat Kreitlow last year was a $10 million race when you include outside money. The money in politics has become outrageous. And, I think finance reform that took place in the early 2000s, the thought process was noble. But in the end, I don't think it's taken money out of politics. I think it's just been disguised with these outside super PAC groups. So, I would get on any proposals out there to see how we reform the way it's done. But you have to do it fairly. You have to take money out from both sides. So if you go, listen, let's take away, you know, corporate dollars. Let's take away union dollars. Let's clear this thing out. I think that would be a better system, and I would support that.
Peter, thanks so much for the phone call. There is a proposal, and I don't know how serious it is, to revert back to the original language in the IRS, which says that those super PACs get their tax exemption only if they are engaged 100% exclusively in social welfare, which would exclude any political expenditures. Do you favor something like that?
I guess I haven't seen the specific legislation, but I would be very interested in taking a look at it. And again, as long
and
as
that's something that would affect liberals and conservatives equally.
Right. Sometimes what I see is one side or the other will go, I've got a great idea to take money out of politics. I'm going to take your money out of politics. I want to leave mine alone. And you have to do this with equality. You have to make sure you take it all out and for everybody. And so you clean it up. I would definitely take a look at that. How do you get these outside groups to get out of politics? Because you look at these, you see these ads come up, groups that you've never heard of, you don't know where the money comes from, are pouring millions of dollars into these races.
And the ads really cheapen the political discourse. It gets to the point where people don't even want to enter politics because they don't want their name smeared.
They don't want to watch TV. They don't want to watch the nightly news.
We want them to listen to public radio.
They listen to public radio. That's right. But it's a situation that has devolved, and I think we could do a better job in how we deal with funding in politics.
Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech. And at that anniversary event, speaker after speaker called for restoring the Voting Rights Act, which was thrown out by the U.S. Supreme Court. One of the people who's been outspoken in saying Congress needs to pass a new Voting Rights Act is Wisconsin's own James Sensenbrenner, a Republican congressman with a very conservative voting record. Here's what he said on the topic earlier this week.
I am committed to restoring the Voting Rights Act as an effective tool to prevent discrimination. With all of the problems that we have with the budget problems and the continuing resolution and the debt ceiling and the snooping by the NSA, this is something that has to be done by the end of the year. It ain't going to be easy, but when we all are together, we shall overcome.
James Sensenbrenner saying he's going to work to ensure that the Voting Rights Act reappears in some shape or form by the end of the year. Congressman Duffy, do you agree with your Republican colleague?
Yeah, I agree with Jim. I think we have to look and see how things have changed, and modify the legislation to meet the problems that we face today. But we don't want to see any discrimination. We want to prevent it. And I would support Jim in his effort to restore the Voting Rights Act to prevent discrimination. For the world that we live in 2013.
Critics say that redistricting in Wisconsin was gerrymandered. They say it gave you a safe Republican district in the north, or at least safer, and gave Democrat Ron Kind a safer Democratic district in the south. Now, a few weeks ago, he was on this show, and he said redistricting in the future should be done by an independent panel, similar to other states. That's also been supported by Republican Congressman Reed Ribble. Do you agree or disagree? Do you think an independent panel should do this in order to take the politics out of it?
Yeah, I would consider the independent panel, but I also look at a process that traditionally is done with a bipartisan group. Usually it was Jim Sensenbrenner, who you just paid, and David Obie sitting down over a cup of coffee or something stronger, and figuring out these lines and how they work. And it's a system that, for the most part, has worked pretty well over the years. Even, you look at, how they're drawn. I don't know that it's perfect, but it's worked for Wisconsin. And, I would look at the commission, but I guess I don't have a great opinion one way or the other. There's so many issues out there, Glenn, right now that we face that are troubling to the people in central and northern Wisconsin. I guess I haven't put a lot of stock in what's happened, a couple years ago in regard to redistricting.
Well, let's move to another one of those issues. If you just joined us, we are talking to Congressman Sean Duffy, a Republican representing the 7th Congressional District. He will be going into his fourth year as the Republican congressman from north central Wisconsin. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question or comment, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. You can also pose a question on the Route 51 Facebook page. As Matt did, he says, you have signed the Taxpayers Protection Pledge to never raise taxes without an equal offset in spending. Considering Marathon County is, even post-Act 10, facing a $1.4 million deficit, how do you suggest we generate the funds on the county level to repair our crumbling infrastructure? Now, you don't have anything to do with county government, but you do have a lot to do with determining how government is funded. So I think the broader question is, how do you generate the funds?
That's a great question.
To fund government if you're cutting taxes.
So some would say that by raising taxes, there's a correlation with increased revenue to the federal coffers. I think if you look at the data, the correlation of increase in revenue to the federal coffers, that correlates with a growing economy, putting more people back to work with better paying jobs. And so when you take money out of the private sector and per this question, you send it to government, thinking the government can spend it more effectively to create more jobs and more opportunity and more prosperity for our community, I don't buy that. I think those who earn their money know how to invest it well. Now, they got to pay a fair percentage of that so we can actually run the government. We need those dollars. But what we've seen today is a government that has expanded so far and so wide to think that we don't have enough revenue to run the basics of our government, and that you have to raise taxes so government can grow even further. I don't think that breeds more opportunity for us. No more job growth in central and northern Wisconsin. And in the end, it doesn't bring more revenue in. A growing economy, policies that will put more people back to work, are policies that bring more revenue into the federal coffers. It makes us more competitive on a global stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'd throw this as an example. You look to California. They've raised their taxes considerably. We read the stories all the time. You don't have more businesses flocking into California. You actually see them leaving and going to Nevada and Texas to lower tax states. And you can see that in a larger spectrum between countries. If you have an ineffective tax rate, you'll see companies and then jobs leave our country. And so we have to find the sweet spot where enough money is coming in, but also we don't hamper the growth of our private sector economy where we live. Most people are employed.
Economist Robert Reich, who's a liberal, notes that the deficit is dropping at the fastest rate in 60 years. He says it will soon comprise what he calls a minuscule 4 percentage points of the GDP. He argues that the deficit is no longer a problem. Do you agree?
I disagree completely. So we're at roughly $17 trillion. And we had the same projections. He's correct. The borrowing rates have come down. Our borrowing levels have come down. We were at over $1 trillion. I think we're going to be between $600 and $800 billion this year. And we had projected that actually happening. And it's going to happen. It's going to stay like that for the next couple of years. And then we see it skyrocket again. You have projected outlays that far exceed revenues that are coming in. This is a problem that we have to get our hands around. $17 trillion in debt, and to say that's not a problem, I would disagree.
House Speaker John Boehner has promised what he calls a whale of a fight over the debt ceiling when you get back into session. This is a quote from him. He says, I've made it clear that we're not going to increase the debt limit without cuts and reforms that are greater than the increase in the debt limit. It's an approach that the president has rejected, his press secretary Jay Carney saying, and here's another quote, let me reiterate what our position is, and it is unequivocal. We will not negotiate with Republicans in Congress over Congress's responsibility to pay the bills that Congress has racked up, period. What do you think will happen? Are we going to have a government shutdown over this?
So first, that is the position of President Obama. I think we're both aware that was not the position of Senator Obama. He had great concerns about the debt limit and American borrowing, and I think he called it unpatriotic, the amount of borrowing that was going on in the country at a time when the debt was far smaller than it is today. So, listen, we have a duty to be responsible, and I'm going to keep all my options on the table, Glenn. I'm not going to lock myself in one way or the other. But as I look at this from 30,000 feet, which is the answer I'm going to give you, I recognize even in the Republican budget that balances in 10 years, we have to borrow for the next 10 years. We have to raise a debt limit for 10 years to get to a point of balance. I'm willing to increase the debt limit, but I do think we have to put America on a course, on a trajectory to balancing our budget. And we're going to need spending or governmental structural reforms to get us on that path. I think the president is going to be hard-pressed to think that Congress is going to raise the debt limit without any reform to the way that we spend or the way that we operate. Even the president's budget and the Senate's budget, that they finally passed one this year, they never balance. We have to get to a point where we get government to live within its means. If the president helps us get there, this is going to be very smooth. It's going to be very easy. If he doesn't, I think we're going to have a political standoff.
Should an increase in the debt ceiling be linked to defunding Obamacare? President of the Americans for Limited Government, a Tea Party organization, has called on Representative Thomas Petri, a Wisconsin Republican, to co-sponsor, I believe it's H.R. 2682, that's legislation to defund the implementation of Obamacare, saying, why not vote to defund it unless the House uses its constitutional power of the purse to defund the law's implementation and amend the law to repeal the Medicaid expansion and insurance exchange subsidies? It appears highly doubtful that Obamacare will ever be rolled back. Now's the time to act before tens of millions of Americans are made dependent on taxpayer-funded health insurance. So do you favor that approach? Do you think we should link defunding Obamacare to the debt ceiling negotiations?
So the conversation I've heard has been less on the debt ceiling and has been more on the CR, the funding mechanism that has to take place before the end of September to defund it in the long-term spending bill that's going to come through the House, because obviously we run out of money at the end of our fiscal year, which is at the end of September. So when we refund the government, they want to defund it in there. And listen, I don't know that your listeners will agree with this, Glenn, but most people see their insurance rates have gone up. I'm concerned about the quality and the access to care that's going to take place under this health care reform bill. So I support an effort to repeal it or to defund it. But I want to be clear, some folks over in the Senate think that if they defund Obamacare, that strategy, if it's done in the House, won't lead to a shutdown. I have a hard time seeing how the Senate will ever pass a defunding of Obamacare.
Right.
I'm hard-pressed to see how the president, this is a signature legislation, this is the one big thing he's done, will defund it, and how that leads to a conservative victory to actually get rid of Obamacare. Frankly, I would tell you, I think the president's probably licking his chops going, great, shut it down, boys. It's great for him, I think.
Worried that a government shutdown could hurt Republicans?
In regard to Obamacare is my concern on that front. I'm not telling you, I'm going to keep my options open. I'm not telling you how I'm going to vote, but I'm concerned the way the president has a massive megaphone. I don't think the media will spin this the way that many conservatives see that it would be spun. And so I think there's better approaches having this conversation with the American people than to put a chain of events in place that would shut the government down. Because in the end,
it's going to hurt a lot of people, servicemen.
The president is one guy that has to hold the line. You need in the House and Senate 280-some Republicans to hold the line. I've been in those conferences, Glenn. I have a hard time seeing how on the Obamacare front that would be they would hold the line. Now, again, there's other efforts that we can make to delay, to stall, to make sure this isn't implemented. I don't think defund the government.
Let me move into
a
question on
Obamacare and shut the government down.
Rich on Facebook has a question on this subject. He says, if one sees a person banging their head repeatedly on a concrete wall, we would likely diagnose it as a mental disease. How does Congressman Duffy explain the 40 GOP congressional votes against Obamacare? The votes have cost taxpayers $60 million. Will he continue this waste of resources and money?
I don't know, waste of resources, but I'll continue my effort to defund a bill that I don't – listen, people who have gotten
Is it crazy to cast 40 votes?
Listen, some of them have been successful. We've taken out pieces or parts of Obamacare that have been unpopular. The president's joined us on some of those. But you have a bill, again, that's that we've seen a promise from the president that rates – premiums would go down after it was signed into law. The truth, Glenn, is that rates have gone up for a family of four anywhere from $25,000 to $3,000. The promises that have been made have not been kept. That's number one. But I'm going to step back to something a little bit different. We have to make sure that we fix Medicare to make sure we pay for Medicare for our seniors. They've bargained for it. They've paid for it. They deserve to get it. Right now, you have Medicare on a trajectory to going bankrupt. So here you have a government that's made a promise to its seniors. We have an obligation in Congress to make sure we keep that obligation to our seniors. But Congress hasn't acted yet to make sure they fix Medicare so it works. So why on earth are we implementing a whole new entitlement system for the rest of America when the American government hasn't figured out to keep its promise to the seniors in America?
The argument is the argument is that Obamacare is going to bring down health costs, and that's going to help Medicare. One of the arguments that was made in passing it.
That was one of the arguments that were made, and that's the first point that I made to you. The promise was that prices would go down.
I've seen statistics indicating that they have gone down in many respects, but I don't have them at my fingertips.
I don't know what publications you're reading. I talk to citizens every day talking about the prices going up. I'm talking to small businesses that are saying, I'm getting a 40% rate increase this year, a 60% rate increase, a 20% rate increase this year alone because of this bill. And they can't eat it. They're going to have to pass it on to families that are under a lot of stress right now, a lot of strain financially, and they can't afford to pay these higher bills with regard to Obamacare. So all the data I've seen, you can find probably a liberal economist who would argue against me, but prices have gone up. So the promise hasn't been kept, the promise that was made.
Francis on Facebook on the same subject, Representative Duffy proposed a replacement for Obamacare. When is that bill going to see the light of day in the House?
Well, I did. I thought it was important that if I'm going to talk about repealing or scaling back Obamacare, I had an obligation to put my ideas on the table. And I did. I put my ideas in the form of a bill that I think would take the control out of bureaucrats in Washington and would empower patients and families and people to make those decisions for themselves, empower the marketplace to work, encourage more competition between our hospitals, our clinics, our doctors, our insurance companies. That was last Congress. There's other bills that are similar to the one that I dropped that are out there today. I don't know when leadership is bringing these up, or if they will. Right now the focus has been on the president's health care reform bill. But the point here is there's Republican ideas that are out there, that I think will work far more effectively. And just one last point on this, Glenn. There's always a conversation, and oftentimes when I come on your show, about bipartisanship and people working together. This is a bill that had no bipartisanship. There was no camaraderie, no coffee around the table to go, how do we bring everyone together and pass this bill? It was rammed through the House by only Democrat votes, rammed through the Senate, and shenanigans had to take place because Scott Brown won that Senate seat in Massachusetts, and the president then signed it. Bipartisanship should apply all the time, not just when it works for the Democrat Party and not the Republican Party. And there was no bipartisanship. And I think that's why you see a lot of pushback.
Democrats say the bill is essentially a Republican bill. It was proposed by Mitt Romney initially in Massachusetts, and a lot of Republican ideas are already in the Obamacare.
So if it's a Republican bill, Glenn, how many Republicans in the House and the Senate voted for it?
Zero.
That's exactly right. So I would tell you, that's not a Republican bill. That's a straight-up Democrat bill.
1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to talk to Republican Congressman Sean Duffy, 1-800-780-9742. You can also find links to his congressional and Facebook pages on our Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're going to talk about immigration when we come back.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic, proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, addressing local, state, and national issues by linking public scholarship, civic outreach, and student service to enhance community life throughout Wisconsin. WIPPS.org.
And we are back with Congressman Sean Duffy on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Mobrig, and we do have we had it here somewhere. We've got a Facebook question from Betsy, who says, how can you sponsor the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, be pro-life, and yet vote against restoring $20.5 billion in appropriations for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and those hurt the most are children?
So, Betsy, great question. We spend about $80 billion a year on the SNAP program or on food stamps. And so the $20 billion that you referenced is over 10 years. We spend $80 billion every year. So this was a $2 billion cut, a little more than $2 billion, out of $80 billion. And to write a question to say, how can you take money away from children and families that need help? Because I'm taking, we're spending $78 billion instead of $80 billion. Is preposterous. There is been a massive increase in funding for food stamps. I want to have a plan in place that continues to care for our children who are in need, who need food on the table, that are hungry, families who have fallen hard times and can't put food on their table. I want to make sure we have a plan in place that will continue to help them out in their time of need. But I also know that we have a system that is giving some resources to folks who can actually get out and work. And I want to make sure we cut out those who are abusing the program and make sure we're giving the resources to the people who actually need it. And to go to the lowest common denominator to say that a couple billion dollars in cuts, $2 billion out of $80 billion spent, is going to take food away from poor children who don't have money to eat is absolutely outrageous in my mind. Dishonest.
Should food stamps be part of the farm bill?
Well, listen, I think we need to pass a farm bill, Glenn, and we weren't able to get one done. Some Republicans said the reform to SNAP wasn't enough reform. Democrats said it was too much, and the farm bill passed. I failed. And so, historically, it's packaged together with the farm portion of the farm bill. To try to get something done, it was split. I want to get a farm bill done. I think there's reforms that need to take place in the farm portion and the SNAP portion. And
if you have to put them together to get it done, you're willing to get it done.
I voted for it when it was together. I voted for it when it was separated. And I hope that now we're going to get the SNAP portion or the food stamp portion of the farm bill done as well in a way that's going to work and we can repackage them and send them to the Senate, but get a farm bill passed.
You have said that you favor an approach to immigration that would allow undocumented immigrants to stay in America and work here without fear of being deported, but you would not grant them the rights of citizens. Talk about that.
Yeah, so there's some on my side of the aisle that think that we should round up 11 million people and ship them home. That's not going to happen. So I think there's a place here where we can get bipartisan support. I had a great hour conversation with Chuck Schumer about how do you find some balance and get something done for people who are here without documentation. I think the first thing you have to do is you have to be able to secure your border. And this isn't security from, mid-1980s with the Reagan era. This is truly securing your border. And if you secure your border where you know who's coming in and out, I think you'll get conservatives to say, listen, all right, this is the last time we're going to have to deal with undocumented immigrants at this scale because we've secured our borders. Let's deal with the 11 million people. Let's give them a legal status so they're not going to be arrested in the middle of the night. They're not going to be separated from their families. They can come out of the shadows. They can travel. They can pay taxes. They can stop living in fear. We also have to have a work visa program that works, that allows people of low skill and high skill labor to come into this country. You need to have an enforcement mechanism internally. If you do that, I think there's a deal that can be done that treats people fairly who have come here and provide great work in our economy, but also treats people fairly as well who have gone through the legal approach to immigrating to America. And what I'm opposed to, Glenn, is any special pathway, any special status that you give to those who've broken our laws so they jump in the front of the line.
Do you think that's going to satisfy the Hispanic community?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of folks, and I talk to them. They go, listen, if you offer them citizenship, they'll be glad to take that. But a main concern is I just talked to someone a couple weeks ago who said, I came here at 16 years old. I've been here for 20 years. I can't travel back home. I haven't seen my parents. If you cut a deal where I get to stay here legally, and I get to travel back home and see my parents, see my siblings, good Lord, do pass that. If you can get that deal done, absolutely. And I think we can not find a solution because we're looking for what's perfect. What I'm trying to do is say, how do we find a situation that can get done, that can make people's lives better and treat everyone involved in the immigration debate fairly? And I think there's a sweet spot here where we can do it that I think Republicans and Democrats can buy into. There'll be a little bit of heartburn on both sides, but I think those who've come the right way will feel okay with this process. But those who are here without documentation, they feel like they've got a fair shake at the deal.
Let's move to another issue. The new EPA chief says the president wants her to focus on climate change. This is from the Anchorage Daily News. And quote, as she marveled at the sight of a shrinking Alaska glacier, the newly installed leader of the Environmental Protection Agency said that the president told her that fighting climate change should be her primary focus. Said EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy, the president's main priority for me was to recognize when I was coming in here that this is going to be a significant challenge and one in which the administration was going to begin to tackle. And the president recently called climate change an emergency, saying we can't wait for a meeting of the Flat Earth Society. Your reaction?
Well, this is, again, the president trying to go it alone, that he's going to try to implement cap and trade, which is a energy tax system that wasn't able to pass the Congress when it was a Democrat Congress even. And so what you see is you're going to see a war on American energy, which is oftentimes coal. And some people might go, well, I don't like coal. In Wisconsin, over 60% of our electricity comes from coal-burning power plants. And again, at a time when people can barely get by right now, they're figuring out how they're paying their utility bill, how they pay their mortgage, how they send their kids to school, you're going to increase their utility bills at a rate and a time that they can't afford. And so you do have to have a balance to try to find a cleaner energy source. It's going to take us time to get there, but to think you're going to make Americans pay through the nose, especially during this downturn, when they're going through tough economic times, I don't think makes a lot of sense.
Do you think that climate change is linked to increases in carbon dioxide caused by human activity?
We've had this conversation a number of times, Glenn. I know that you believe that.
Well, I believe it because I work for the University of Wisconsin.
That's right. And you're on NPR, so of course you believe that.
Well, the University of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Public Radio is the educational arm of the university, and I can't find a climate scientist working at this university who believes otherwise.
Well, I guess if you look at global temperatures over the last 10 years, have the global temperatures been going up, staying the same, or going down? And the data that I've read says it's not going up over the last 10 years. And actually, there's been a little bit of a concern, and even the language that you use, global climate change, that has modified from global warming, because they understood that, well, maybe the Earth's not warming. We've got to use global climate change because there's other things that are taking place here that don't really relate to warming.
Glaciers are melting. The North Pole, the ice cap is shrinking. They're talking about the Pentagon using the Arctic Ocean as a new conduit a lot of stuff is happening. Sea levels are rising. Coral reefs are being bleached. Fish populations are dying. And we've got all these hurricanes and F5 tornadoes and a wildfire outside of Yosemite that's bigger than the city of Chicago.
So we'll talk about two things there. If you look at the fire first, you have a forestry service that's unwilling to harvest and manage our national forest. We see that happening here in Wisconsin. When you don't manage it, you have a lot of underbrush, you have dead trees that fall, and it is ripe to burn. And so instead of harvesting it and creating jobs in an industry around our national forest, and we know how to do it well, this isn't 100 years ago, instead they're burning and driving more pollutants into the air.
You just participated in a conference on that very subject
on that very topic up in
Leona.
That's
recently.
Right. Our forest products industry is really important to us, and it's a huge economic driver. A lot of economic growth and jobs are created from forestry. We need to have a national forest that works for us, and right now it's not. We're not managing the forest correctly. A lot of our timber is dying, and if you're a good liberal from San Francisco and you come and walk through the national forest and you walk through a 40 that has been managed and a 40 that has been unmanaged, and you ask them which one is more beautiful, hands down they'll go, oh, the managed forest is far more beautiful. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't have sections that we can leave alone. But you have a near-dying industry here. And once it dies, it doesn't come back to life right away when you say, okay, we'll start to harvest again. That gives us some concern.
Well, we have hit all of my bullet points. I didn't think it was possible, but you've been very succinct, and you talked really quickly today, Congressman Duffy. So thanks so much for both of those things. And I know you've got to leave a little bit early to get to another appointment. Is there anything you'd like to add, something you'd like to leave our listeners with before we move on?
It's my dad's fault that I talk so fast. I apologize. I'm a quick talker. I learned that in the old Duffy family. But listen, I know that we have a lot of diverse views on your program, and I'm honored to represent all those views and do the best I can not to represent a party or an ideology, but to do the best I can to represent the people that are here. And I know some people that listen to us today will go, well, that's not the right position. You know, you need to defund the government on Obamacare. And others will go, yes, there is global warming. Listen, I'm doing the best I can to represent everybody. And the way I do that is when people will reach out and share their opinions and views, whether it's an email off my website, duffy.house.gov, a Facebook post, writing a letter to our office or a call. I do value your input. I see all the stuff that comes in from all of you. So I would encourage you, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I'd appreciate you to share it with me. And I just one comment. I think it's nice in Wisconsin. My experience is when there's a differencing of opinions and views, we can be not disagreeable, but not agree.
And that's, I think, it's the old Barry Goldwater quote. You can disagree without being disagreeable.
And you see that really, I think, in the central and northern Wisconsin. And I appreciate that. People don't always agree with me, but they're not disagreeable, and we're all respectfully engaging in the American conversation on government. And so thanks for having me on, and I look forward to doing this again.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for being here. We always love to have you on the show, and we will do it again soon.
Great. Thank you.
Congressman Sean Duffy, Republican from the 7th Congressional District. We'll be back with some analysis by political scientist Eric Giordano after this. I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have been listening, we had a very fast-paced, very fascinating, and I think illuminating discussion with 7th District Republican Congressman Sean Duffy. And joining us now is Eric Giordano, political science professor at UW-Marathon County and the executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Eric, you listened to the last portion of the program. What do you take away from it?
That congressman is just so darn agreeable. Whether you disagree with his policies or not, I think, Glenn, we both agree he's a great interview. And, you know, he's a very energetic representative of this region. And, you know, I think I appreciate the fact that he's willing to address some of these tough issues. I think he's taken a pass on a few tough issues as well, and maybe that's worth talking about. But, you know, there are certainly some things that I think most voters here could agree with him about, things like we really have had deficit issues, and that issue really needs to get taken care of. I mean, whatever you think about, you know, the Republicans sort of stonewalling, you know, with things like deficit ceilings and those sorts of things. I mean, you know, they were elected with a mandate in part to help reduce the deficit, and I think Sean Duffy is fulfilling that pledge. I think there's a few issues that, you know, could be discussed that have been skirted a little bit. I think the gerrymandering issue is huge. I think if for all citizens of Wisconsin, I mean, we should really be paying attention to this issue. I think studies show there's only about 75 competitive House districts now left in the country, out of 435.
And what that does is it adds to the extremism of congressional members, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and causes a lack of compromise, because these people aren't worried at all about attracting people from the other party when they run for office. They're worried about getting primaried by the extremists in their own party.
Right. So, I mean, it's interesting to me that the Republicans are usually the group that likes to talk about term limits, but the gerrymandering that's gone on has actually worked to inhibit the need for term limits or the desire for term limits, because they're solid seats.
And we should mention people in Wisconsin, a lot of people in Stevens Point were upset when that was cut from the 7th Congressional District, allegedly to give Mr. Duffy a safer district. But the Democrats, when they controlled the governorship and both houses, the Assembly and the Senate, they could have pushed for an independent panel to make those redistricting decisions, and they didn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to pick on the Republicans this time around, but clearly, there's need for reform, and both parties have to be involved, and both have to agree, and therefore the bipartisan commission concept is really the only way we're going to get this done. It's just harder right now for the Republicans to want to pay any attention to that, because, you know, they were the victors of the last round. So, but we really need an independent commission to do this.
You know, we've got kind of a yin and yang, an in and out, a sine wave of politics where one party's in for a while and another party's out. It would appear to many observers to make sense to somehow get redistricting outside of the hands of the political parties.
It really has to be. On the other hand, you really do need representation of both, you know, conservatives and liberals on this so-called
whatever redistricting panel it would
correct,
be.
Correct, correct.
Let's move on to something that Congressman Duffy talked about at the start of the program. We talked about Syria, and he is one of the people who signed that letter to the president saying the full Congress should be involved in this before we take any military action. And Congressman Duffy said, look, we went overboard with George W. Bush in not providing enough oversight.
Well, I just have to say that this is a very traditional mess-up fight, if you will, between the executive and the legislative branch. I mean, this has been going on since the Vietnam War. Congress wants more power. They believe it's their power to declare war or any acts that appear like war, and the executive wants to maintain the ability to do these things without congressional approval. Now, you know, I'm not going to come down either side here, but I mean, it's within Congressman Duffy's rights and prerogative as a member of Congress to insist on this. And, you know, let's face it, Obama has really painted himself into a tough corner in Syria with his red line rhetoric, and this is a lose-lose situation. This mm-hmm. is not a positive situation for the administration, and it's going to be very interesting to see how, you know, they get out of this one, or if they drag America into something that we don't want to be involved in.
And one of the points he made is, what is our goal here? What's the definition? Are we trying to topple the Assad regime? Are we just trying to make some kind of a political point that chemical weapons is something that nobody tolerates? And if so, how many people have to die in order for us to make that point?
Right. And what's the – yeah, exactly. What is the outcome? What are the goals? We all know Assad is a bad actor, but he's backed by a regime of a cadre of people that are much deeper than just the Assad family itself. And what is the alternative? You've got a bunch of factions here fighting against Assad, many of which are bad actors that we all agree. You just look at the case of Egypt. We thought Egypt was – on a fast pace towards democratic reform. Well, it's more complicated than that. I mean, they're really going through, a period of struggle over what democracy mm-hmm. means and what it looks like. And there are a number of actors that are not, interested in America or in what America stands for. And I would say the same is true in Syria. We could be in some trouble here.
One of the things that Congressman Duffy talked about at the start of the program, and he may have made a little bit of news here, he says he supports Congressman James Sensenbrenner's call to bring back the Voting Rights Act and to do it by the end of the year, a position that not all members of his own party are taking.
Yeah, I applaud Sensenbrenner. I mean, I think if you're someone who believes in the right of Americans to vote, regardless of race, creed, color, orientation, I think you have to be in favor of the Voting Rights Act. I understand why the Supreme Court had to strike down certain provisions, but on the other hand, I think it really is Congress's responsibility to ensure we don't fall backwards in the rights of many voters, especially in areas that have a history of discrimination. So, if you're a voter, if you're someone who believes in voting rights, you've got to applaud Sensenbrenner. I think the one thing Duffy made it clear, though, that we have to listen to were his words, which were something along the lines of, but we have to update it for 2013. So
right.
There are some caveats here, and the devil's in the details. What does that really mean, updating it for 2013? He's probably right, but we need to see what that's going to look like.
He again defended Congress voting 40 times to repeal Obamacare or parts of it. He continues to believe that it's a bad bill and needs to be repealed and replaced. And he predicted that there would be an effort to tie it to the debt limit argument, which could lead to a government shutdown, something that he doesn't favor because he says it would be catastrophic not only for America but probably for the Republican Party.
We held a conference on this back in June on the effect on the state of Wisconsin here in Wausau. And what we learned from that conference is that even if the Republicans were somehow successful in, turning back this bill, there won't be any major changes in the Obamacare program for at least several years. So, Americans are going to grow used to this. We're going to be accepting of it. And, these attempts are really, frankly, a bit of a waste of time. Because, as he admitted himself, this is Obama's, main legislation. He is not going to go back on
it. It's a signature issue.
Right. And the Senate's not going to vote it down, so.
Eric Giordano, thanks so much for sitting in for the last few minutes of the show. The entire program has gone very quickly. And once again, it's wonderful having somebody like you and an organization like the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service here at our fingertips, right down the hallway from us, to help us out with programs like this. Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you. You're too kind.
And we'd also like to thank, of course, 7th District U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy. Thanks to our executive producer and our on-air producer, Rick Ryer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. If you missed part of this program, a reminder that Route 51 is now rebroadcast every Friday evening at 7 o'clock on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Next Thursday morning on Route 51, we talk to the folks behind a decades-long science experiment on the effects of acid rain on a Northwoods lake, Little Rock Lake near Minocqua. The experiment concluded a few weeks ago with the removal of a barrier that split the lake into two halves. One half was exposed to gradual, diluted doses of acid. The other was left untouched. That experiment has already affected national policy and, according to its proponents, benefited the global environment. That's next Thursday at 10. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.